Joshua chapter, we finished chapter 4, but let's read the last few verses to get an idea of where we were. Joshua chapter 4. The scene is at the edge of the promised land. The Lord has promised them a particular piece of land all the way back when it was just Abraham, and promised that his descendants would get it over 400 years ago. And they are now on the border of going into that land. Could have been there 40 years before that, but didn't quite have the faith to get in, so they stayed out, wandered for 40 more years. Now finally they're there. Moses is dead, Aaron's dead, and Joshua is leading. They've already sent the spies in to Jericho, the walled city right on the other side of the Jordan, where they're first going to cross over to spy it out, where they ran into Rahab, the prostitute, who exercised faith on the little thing that she knew about God. She had exercised faith, and that faith is memorialized for us, and that one, she's in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11, but more amazingly, that prostitute's in the lineage of Christ, which is hard to imagine, but yet. The Lord blessing her for trusting what little she heard. And so last week we were there. The Israelites are waiting to go over, and they're in front of this river that's anywhere from a half mile to a mile wide. It's at flood stage. It's an insurmountable thing. I mean, how do you get 2 to 3 million people and all your stuff across a river when there's no bridge? And barges, do you try to float everything across? And you know, I can barely get my kids to the grocery store, and I only have 2 to 3 million across a river with, there's just no way. And the inhabitants of Jericho watching from behind their walled city, able to see 2 to 3 million people camped on the other side. And then the ark, the Lord telling Joshua to have the ark, the thing that represented the presence of the Lord, to go out ahead of them into the water, and the one side drying out, the other side starting to pile up in a heap as it just kept backing up and backing up and backing up. And they walked across on dry land, 2 to 3 million people, and something that would have taken maybe months to figure out logistically happens in a day. You know, a situation that they saw no way to get around, that their enemies were taking comfort in the fact that they had this river as a barrier, is just suddenly evaporated, literally, in one day. It's there they are on the other side. And remember when they came out, and look at verse 15, we'll read from there. It says, "And the Lord spake unto Joshua, saying, Command the priests that bear the ark of the testimony that they come up out of Jordan." And this is, of course, after all the people are out, so nobody gets drowned. "And it came to pass, when the priests that bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord were come up out of the midst of Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet were lifted up unto the dry land, that the waters of Jordan returned to their place and flowed over all his banks as they did before." And there it is, the water all comes back. And I'm sure that, I imagine the thrill in the Israelites' hearts to hear that sound and know that their God is strong enough to back up a river for a day so that they can walk across. It says, "And the people came up out of Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and encamped at Gilgal in the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of Jordan did Joshua pitch in Gilgal. And he spake unto the children of Israel, saying, When your children shall ask their fathers in time to come, saying, What mean these stones? Then you shall let your children know, saying, Israel came over this Jordan on dry land. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of Jordan from before you until you were passed over, as the Lord your God did in the Red Sea, which he dried up before us until we were gone over, that all the people of the earth might know the hand of the Lord, that it is mighty, that you might fear the Lord your God forever." And he told them, remember, to take 12 stones out of the middle, one for each tribe, grab one of those big river rocks, slimy, old, mossy river rocks, and haul it up on the bank and build a pile. And you know immediately a pile of rocks will tweak a little boy, and he'll want to hang off them and climb off them and want to know what they're for. And he says, so that your fathers, the parents, the dads, can say, this is here as a memorial of when God worked on our behalf and brought us across. And, you know, what a exhortation for us to be setting up memorials for our kids, things that they will remember about the times that the Lord was faithful. it is important to remember. And that memorial built in Gilgal, plus there was one in the middle that was the private one that Joshua, it told us earlier, set up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan as well. One that was just for them and God. Nobody would see it from the outside, but it was that inner memorial of what the Lord did. So here they are on the other side. They're finally in the land. This is it. They're ready to go. They've got Jericho in front of them. It's time. And it says, and it came to pass when all the kings of the Amorites, which were on the side of the Jordan westward, and all the kings of the Canaanites, which were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of Jordan from before the children of Israel until we were passed over. Note that, we were passed over. Sounds like Joshua's writing this. It wasn't they, it's we. That their heart melted, neither was their spirit in them anymore because of the children of Israel. You know, they had... They're coming into this land, and it's an idolatrous land, okay? It's a land that is filled with false gods. There's no lack of gods anywhere you go. And it's the same way today. There's no lack of gods. Everybody's got what they think God is intellectually, and then they have what they make God practically with their heart, the thing that you follow, the thing that takes the focus of your time, the thing that you worship, maybe yourself, maybe your belly button, whatever it is that you worship, but everybody has something. And that this land was filled with gods. They were idolatrous. They had turned from the living God and they were worshiping whatever, whatever was convenient at the time. But all of a sudden they were confronted with a people. And it's interesting because the witness to the people of the land was these guys have an obstacle in front of them that's impossible for them to pass. And their God brought them through it in a minute. And all of a sudden, everybody in the land, all of the kings, realized, I have picked the wrong team. I have picked the wrong God. Because, you know, the fact that an impossible barrier was removed was an undeniable witness. And, you know, a lot of times, we can have a lot of words to say. You know, those of us who are evangelical, which means we feel like we should be sharing our faith, which is what the Bible clearly says to do, you feel like, I just got to get that argument right. You know? Why is it he can say it like that? How come the guy that I'm listening to, and I'm not saying me because I'm an idiot, but I mean, you know, why is it the good preachers? How come the ones in the big towns, not this one? Why is it they always know exactly what to say, and they can take that argument and they can just go blah 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 at just the right time and just the right moment, and I just, if I could just get that right, and I try, and yet when I go to try to witness and I try to use the words that God put in their mouth, it comes out all stupid when I say it, and somebody brings up something that I just don't know the answer to, and I'm just clueless. But there were no words spoken at all in this situation. There really weren't. I mean, and what I have found, you know, is it requires more than just words. The witness to your God is one of power in your life. You remember what Paul said? And Paul's a sharp guy, you know. And Paul was extremely bright. I mean, I look through the New Testament, and I realize, of all the guys, I mean, Peter, he wasn't that smart when he was with Jesus. After Jesus left and the Holy Spirit came upon him, he starts saying some smart stuff. I mean, we're going through Peter on Sunday nights. You got to read some of that a few times. I mean, he says Paul's stuff is hard to understand. I think sometimes Peter's is, but Paul, man, he's a smart guy. He uses arguments. He writes sentences that are like 3 pages long. And it's just like, I didn't even know there were those punctuation marks. Is that right? Can you even string those together that way? Where does this stop? You know, how do you even breathe in? Do you even take a breath in that? And Paul quotes the Old Testament. And we see him having, you know, a pretty powerful witness. Obviously, he wrote a lot of the New Testament. But one of the places that blesses me the most is Acts chapter 17. Because Paul goes to Mars Hill. You remember? And Mars Hill was like where the smart folk hung out. That was where all of the culturally elite and the well-educated hung out. And they liked to just sit around and talk about high-minded religious things, spiritual things. We're very spiritual. we care about spiritual things, you know. And they probably smoked pipes, and they, you know, they were spiritual, and they wore slippers, and they drove a Subaru, and, you know, I mean, that's what they were. They were very spiritual. They probably were teachers. And Paul goes there, and he says, all right, I'll have a shot at them, you know. And when you read what he says, that's when he goes in there and he sees all the altars. There's an altar to every god you can imagine, including an empty one. The flat table that says, to the unknown god. And Paul says, well, I need to build a bridge. Let me build a bridge. And he goes in and he says, I see that you're very religious. And he goes into this sermon and he quotes some of the poets of the day, and he says, I see this unknown God, and let me declare this unknown God who he is, the one that you don't know. You know all these other ones, but let me tell you the one that you do know. And he some people hold that up as the model of what you're supposed to do in witnessing. This is the way you go. You're culturally relevant. You do 3 points in a poem, and you build a bridge, and you say all this stuff. And then at the very end of it, he finally gets down to the meat and potatoes, and he starts talking to them about repentance and resurrection from the dead. And as soon as he did that, they all start making fun of him, and they say, oh, we'll talk to you again about this. And at the end, it says a couple people believe, but by and large, they rejected him. Okay, that was Paul. That's the smartest guy around, as far as I'm concerned, biblically. He's, you know, next to Jesus. He's got his thing down. But then he goes to Corinth, and he's bummed out at that point, and Jesus actually appears to him and comforts him and says, don't worry, don't be afraid, I've got a lot of people in this city. He comes into chapter 2 when he writes this letter to Corinth, and he said, you know, when I came to you, he said, I determined. Well, look what he says. He says in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 1, it says, and I, brethren, when I came to you, I came not with excellency of speech or wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God. I didn't even bother. For I determined not to know anything among you save Jesus Christ and him crucified. That's it. You know, let's just get back to the basics. Let's just talk about Jesus. Forget all of the theological debate. Let's just talk about Jesus. Let's go right there. He says, and I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, which blesses my heart. And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. And he came there and he spoke plain. He talked about Jesus, and there was power in what he said and what he did. There was a powerful witness in his life. Now, we know he did miracles throughout there, and the Lord backed up his bravery and his leading of the Holy Spirit with powerful witnesses. But personally, I look through Paul's life, and some of the most powerful witnesses I see is when he goes into a town and everybody hates him and they stone him so that he's dead. And they throw him outside the city and they throw him on a pile because he's dead. And then he gets back up and he brushes himself off and he trots right back into the city again. Tweaked. I mean, obviously, it said he came back to life. It didn't say that his scars went away and he wasn't all messed up. I mean, if somebody throws rocks at your head hard enough to kill you, they did some damage. And Paul was jacked up and he was beaten and he was whipped and he was stoned. But yet, the Lord preserved him and he kept coming back. And it was the power of that witness in somebody's life. Because, you know, it's one thing to say you have a God when you don't have any problems. And it's one thing to say God when you don't face any trials. But when you go through the ringer of life and you're messed up and you're jacked up by this world, and yet people see you standing and talking about Jesus with a hope and with a love that they don't see anywhere else, they're going to know you got a real God. And I think a lot of times our problem is that we're so worried about the words that we forget about the power of the Holy Spirit working in our lives and empowering us to be a witness. You know, Jesus said that's what he's for, to give us the power to be a witness, not to run our lips, but to be a witness. And I think that's what Israel had. They crossed over and everybody just fainted. All the enemies just dropped because their heart, there wasn't spirit in them anymore, it said, because they saw that. They saw that testimony of their life and they were blown away. So back in Joshua chapter 5, verse 2, so they come across and here they are. They're ready to go. Now, battle plan. You know, you're waiting to fight. I mean, when you're getting ready to compete, I wasn't really a fighter, but I played basketball and everything, and you kind of have that nervous time in the locker room when you get all your gear on and you're ready to go and you spend time in the toilet. You know, you're really just getting ready because you want to throw up or you don't know what you want to do, but you're ready to go and you're thinking, now's the time, and we're here and it's time to fight and we got our men of war and here we go. And it says, at the time the Lord said unto Joshua, make thee sharp knives. Yeah, sharp knives. Now I'm ready. That's what I'm talking about. Let's get the sharp knife out. And circumcise again the children of Israel a second time. Aren't we supposed to be using the knives on them? Isn't that, what's the knife in me? I mean, why do we have to do anything on me? I want a knife to do them. Let's cut that stuff off of them. I don't want anybody cutting me. I'm going to fight. I'm supposed to be ready to fight. You know, you go into a fight, you don't want to be cut. You want to be whole. You know, I don't get this whole thing, this circumcise. But look what he says. He says, God says to Joshua, make thee sharp knives and circumcise again the children of Israel the second time. And Joshua made him sharp knives. Flinty is the idea, as in sharp rocks. And circumcised the children of Israel. We're talking 2 to 3 million Israelites. You figure you got, what, 50% are male, roughly, maybe a million. And where were they circumcised? At the hill of the foreskin. I think it was just called, I mean, how big could that hill have been? I mean, truly, you know, I got to figure it was just because it was on a hill that they did it. I can't believe that there was actually a mountain of, anyways, I'll just keep going. But, and it says, this is the cause why Joshua did circumcise all the people that came out of Egypt, that were males, even all the men of war, died in the wilderness by the way after they came out of Egypt. Now all the people that came out were circumcised, but all the people that were born in the wilderness by the way that came forth out of Egypt, them they had not circumcised. For the children of Israel walked 40 days in the wilderness, till all the people that were men of war which came out of Egypt were consumed, because they obeyed not the voice of the Lord, unto whom the Lord sware that he would not show them the land which the Lord sware unto their fathers that he would give us, a land that floweth with milk and honey. And their children, whom he raised up in their stead, them Joshua circumcised, for they were uncircumcised because they had not circumcised them by the way. Now, if you remember this whole thing with circumcision, what is that all about? It first comes up in Genesis chapter 17. With Abraham, when God has made this promise to Abraham, saying, I got a land for you, I got a place for you, I'm going to do all this stuff for you, and this is what I want you to do. Well, in verse 3 of Genesis 17, it says, Abraham fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant's with thee, and when it shall be the father of many nations, and neither shall thy name be called any more Abram, but thy name shall be Abraham. For a father of many nations have I made thee, and I will make thee exceeding fruitful, and I will make nations of thee, and kings shall come out of thee, and I will establish my covenant between me and thee, thy seed after thee, and their generations, for an everlasting covenant, to be a God unto thee, and thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee, and to thy seed after thee, the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. That was the deal. Did you notice? There was really not a whole lot of terms on Abraham's side at this point, like none. Like everything was God saying, oh yeah, and I'll do this and make you that and give you that. Okay, good, that's a deal. And then he says, and God says unto Abraham, thou shalt keep my covenant therefore. Well, I should be able to keep that, okay, because you're doing it all. Thou and thy seed after thee in their generations. This is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man-child among you shall be circumcised. And you shall circumcise the flesh of your foreskin, and it shall be a token of the covenant betwixt me and you. And this was something, and other groups of people had practiced this, but the Lord said, for you guys, this is what I want you to do as a sign of the fact that you guys are in a covenant with me, is I want you to cut away a little piece of skin. I want that cut away. That's the deal. Now, in Abraham did that, old man, 75, I think, when he did that. He was an old guy. And we see that coming along through. That was the sign of the covenant down through Isaac, down through Jacob, all that. Exodus, after they're brought out of Egypt, when they were in Egypt, they didn't do it anymore. That wasn't done. And then when Moses was called to lead them out, you remember Moses is getting ready to take the children of Israel out of there. God's just told him, you're the guy, I'm going to use you, I'm going to do all this stuff. And then he's walking to go do what he was told, and it says the Lord shows up ready to kill him. And it's a weird little thing in Exodus chapter 4 where his wife, Zipporah, immediately grabs a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and cast it at his feet. Because apparently the Lord was really ticked because Moses hadn't done this thing. He knew what he was supposed to do. God's already said, I'm going to do all this stuff with you, but Moses was being disobedient for whatever reason. He hadn't cut that off. And it was a big enough deal that even though God had said, you're going to be the guy, because of his disobedience, he wasn't going to be, but his wife finally relented and allowed him to do what it was God was telling him to do. So his wife finally relented and allowed him to do what God was telling him to do. Okay, let's keep going. Then we get into Leviticus. You know, they're out, they're in the land, they're at Sinai, the law is given, and boom, it's given again. You're supposed to circumcise your kids. That's what you're supposed to do. Okay? And then what happens? It says they went 40 years in the wilderness, and they never did it. Again, they never did it. They're told, this is what you're supposed to do. The law came. They heard the voice at the beginning. Moses heard it at the end. But yet, they never practiced it for 40 years. And yet, in Deuteronomy, near the end of it, before Moses is dead, the Lord is talking to them, and he's saying, you're going to come into this land. And he says something strange. He says, the Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart in the heart of thy seed, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, that thou may live. And yeah, that circumcision needs to happen physically. That was something that they were to do as an outward sign. But apparently it was just an outward sign of something inside, that there was something inside that needed to get cut away. Which is good, because if it was just an outward thing, you ladies would be off the hook. But seeing how it goes into the heart, this kind of applies to you too. And so the idea is, this outward thing of the cutting off of the flesh represents an inward thing. You know, we see that in the New Testament where Paul tells us to stand fast in the liberty that we've been called. And that, you know, if we are trusting in some outward action in circumcision, it's in Galatians 5, Christ doesn't profit you anything. But if you're trusting in an inward change of your heart, then you're a child of God. Look what it says in Colossians chapter 2, verse 14. It says, you are complete in him, speaking of Christ, which is the head of all principality and power, in whom also you are circumcised with the circumcision made without hands, in the putting off of the body of the sins of the flesh by circumcision of Christ. Buried with him in baptism, also you're risen with him through faith. And he talks about an inward thing where the flesh is put away, you know, where that stuff that gets between you and God kind of gets taken out of the way. I mean, you remember last week, he told them before they went across the river, I want you guys to sanctify yourselves. Get apart and commit yourself to be where you're supposed to be, okay? Consecrate yourself unto the Lord. And then he takes them through the water. And then today on the other side, before they go into the fight, he says, now you need to have the flesh cut away. You need to renounce. And the flesh talks a lot of sin and of the old guy, the old woman. That needs to just be cut off and taken out. You know? And it doesn't seem to make any sense that the Lord would want them to do this right before they fight, because it really makes you completely defenseless as a man. You know, I'm a UFC fight fan. We usually watch those fights. There's not a whole lot of rules, but there are a couple. And one of the rules is you wear some protective gear in certain places because it's very tender. And the second rule is, even if he's wearing protective gear, if you kick him there, you could lose the fight. Everything stops until he completely recovers, because he is incapacitated with one blow in a really sensitive area. And these guys are getting ready to go into war, and they've all just had a knife put to a very sensitive area. And there's a reason why they do that when a child is really little. One, because in the Lord's instruction is in the eighth day. And we found out medically for a couple reasons. One, that is when your nerve endings are not yet well enough developed that you feel everything as much as you could, but yet in the eighth day is when vitamin K starts being produced, which is the clotting factor. That's why when you have a baby and they do it early, they always give you a shot of vitamin K so that you'll clot. Because if you do it on the sixth day or the fifth day, they could bleed to death. But God somehow knew that around the eighth day is when vitamin K starts. But they do it when they're a little kid because they can't feel as much. When you're older, it's a whole different ball game. We say all the stuff about the Israelites, like, oh, those complainers, those whiners, they never did what God said. Well, I'll tell you what, there was some faith exercise right there by 600,000 men who ponied up to the knife, especially as that mountain started to grow, you know, and they're seeing all their friends try to make their way off that hill and get alone and just nobody near me for, you know, a week. And on one hand, it doesn't make any sense. Why would you possibly do that when you're getting ready to fight. But the cool thing is, it's because they weren't going to do the fighting. You know, this is where they're going. They're going in to fight Jericho, and Jericho is not their battle to fight. They're just to really watch it and see it happen, you know? And so it's not about getting themselves mentally or physically prepared for battle. It's about getting themselves mentally and physically prepared to be on the Lord's side and not have any flesh in the way of what he wants to do. You know, Joshua is a seasoned military leader, okay? He was put over the top of the army as soon as they come out. Their first battles with Amalek back in Exodus 17. And yet, even in that very first battle, he's leading the army, and Moses and Aaron and Hur are up on the top of the hill. And Joshua realizes that whenever Moses' hands are up, they win. And when they go down, they lose. And he learns this really valuable lesson that, you know, this whole fighting on the side of God's army thing, it ain't got nothing to do with me at all. All I got to do is be out here where he told me to be, and this is won and lost somewhere else completely. And the same way for us, it's not our battle. It's not their battle. They're not going to have to fight. All I need to do is get rid of anything that gets between them and the Lord, because he's the one who's going to win the battle. And so they do it, amazingly. They all circumcise themselves. And you got to wonder, what are the people inside the city of Jericho thinking? I don't know if they could really see from where they were at that this was all going on, but the Lord knew, and they did it, and they circumcised, they cut away the flesh. And you know, for us, look, here we are, and we are in a battle. As soon as you become a Christian, you start swimming upstream. There is a battle, and there are things that we face in our life, and most of the things we face are going to be things that we can't possibly win on our own. And so the Lord is calling us, look, set yourself aside, and then get rid of the junk. Get rid of the flesh. Get rid of the things that separate you from me. And, you know, we need to be obedient just like they were. And the Lord said unto Joshua, this day have I rolled away the reproach of Egypt from off you. Wherefore the name of this place is called Gilgal unto this day, which means to roll away. And it's interesting. It only took, a day really when the Passover happened for them to get out of Egypt. It was one day. He killed the firstborn, they're out. And yet it was 40 years to get Egypt out of them until they finally were in the place where they would cut off the remainder of the flesh that they never dealt with in Egypt. They finally do it here before they go into battle. And it says in verse 10, okay, now we're ready to fight. Here we go. We've healed up now. They healed up, they were made whole there in verse 8. When they had done circumcising, they abode in their places in the camp till they were whole. And the Lord said to Joshua, this day I've rolled away the reproach. And then in verse 10, and the children of Israel encamped in Gilgal and kept the Passover on the 14th day of the month at even in the plains of Jericho. Okay, now do we fight? We're all healthy again? Nope, something else you got to do. You got to keep the Passover. Now this is only the second time they've ever kept the Passover. The first time was when it really happened. You remember that was when they got delivered from Egypt. The angel of death going to pass through. It was the final plague on Egypt to get them out of the land. And anybody who took the blood of the lamb and put it on their doorpost, their child, their firstborn was spared. And anybody who didn't, wasn't. And it's interesting to note that the Egyptians could have put blood on their doorposts and their children would have been spared. It was open to all of them. And some of them did, because we heard when they come out, they were a mixed multitude. There were some Egyptians that heard and did that. And so now, here they are, 40 years later, and they haven't kept the Passover since. It was instituted, it was talked about in the law, but it wasn't done again until right now when they're ready to go in. And it's like, okay, why? Well, okay, we're ready to go in, we're ready to go to battle, we've crossed over this river, we've gone through forsaking this sin, you know, the cutting away of the flesh, we've done that, now what's next? Well, immediately after that, they go right into the Passover, which speaks of fellowship with God. And, you know, before you go into battle, once you cut off the junk, boom, you're in fellowship with God. And there's this opportunity for them to remember what the Lord had done and how they were bought, how they were purchased, how they were not their own. Because they're going to go into this battle and realize they can't do it on their own. And they can't do that without fellowship with God. Now, for me, that kind of strikes me, because well, a lot of times I'll jump into the battle without really spending time in fellowship with God, without remembering what he's done for me, the fact that I'm bought, without getting alone and getting into communion with him. You know, communion for us, we share the same piece of bread, we share wine from the same cup, although they're in little cups, it's from the same bottle. So, you know, in a lot of different ways, there is a union from that, a unity that comes from us sharing that. But it's also with Christ, because he took the cup and he took the bread, and it reminds us of his blood and his body that was broken. And so that was the first thing they did before they get into the land. I'm sure this next verse was very good news to them, and it says, "And they did eat of the old corn of the land on the morrow after the Passover, unleavened cakes and parched corn in the selfsame day. And the manna ceased on the morrow after they had eaten of the old corn of the land. Neither had the children of Israel manna any more, but they did eat of the fruit of the land of Cana that year." Because they've been eating the same stuff for about 38 years. You know, I don't know, I kind of go through cycles of food that I like. Like, you can do anything for a while. I remember as a kid going through the peanut butter and jelly phase, and it was peanut butter and jelly all the time. Just make me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, crunchy peanut butter, grape jelly, Wonder Bread, and I'm good to go. Every meal, I'm fine with it. Then it was cereal. It was cereal 3 meals a day. That's all I needed to eat. Just give me that. There was a whole, when I was first out on my own, cream corn on toast phase, where it was just, you know, because it was easy, and it was like a complete meal for me. I had my bread, I had my corn, I had everything, you know, that's all you need. So I just kind of made that. I couldn't cook all that well. I didn't pay much attention to mom at home. So, you know, that was my meal, and I just go through. Well, these guys have been eating the same food for 38 years, except for one time where they had enough meat that they puked. So they probably didn't want that for 38 years. But other than that, it's the same food over and over, and finally they're in the land. And the first thing about coming in the land is the food is good. You know, and I even, yeah, it was the old corn, the old wheat from the previous year, but I'm sure they were praising God for the fact they had dietary change. It says in verse 13, "And it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there stood a man over against him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went unto him and said unto him, Art thou for us or for our adversaries? And he said, Nay, but as captain of the host of the Lord, I am now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and did worship and said unto him, What saith my Lord unto his servant? And a captain of the Lord's host said unto Joshua, Loose thy shoe from off thy foot, for the place whereon thou standest is holy. And Joshua did so." This is a very odd thing. They're getting ready to go into battle, and all of a sudden Joshua sees somebody standing there armed that he doesn't recognize. And so, you know, he does the classic, halt, who goes there, you know. Are you for us or are you against us? Pretty much figuring it's going to be an A or B type question, you know. Are you for us or are you against us? There's really no other position. You're either for us or you're against us. But the guy, the man, says, no. What do you mean no? What's no? It's nay. Nay? Are you for us or are you against us? And yet, he says, nay. But as the captain or the commander of the host of the Lord, I am now come. Am I now come? This is a very difficult passage for an Orthodox Jew, because they don't know what to do with this guy. Because he's a man. And yet, he does something weird. Joshua drops on his face to the earth and worships. You're really not supposed to do that to a man. In fact, you're not supposed to do that to an angel. We see even John, when he's in Revelation, he's caught up in heaven, and there's an angel there that just blows him away because the angel's awesome, and he just drops down and worships, and the angel's like, get up, man, don't be doing that. I am just a servant like you. Worship God. That's the only one you're supposed to worship. And yet this guy allows it to happen. He doesn't say, don't worship me. In fact, he says, take off your shoes because you're standing on holy ground. Now, that is exactly something that Moses heard back in Exodus chapter 3 when he saw the burning bush. It says, "And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he said, Draw not nigh hither. Don't come close. Put off the shoes from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. God called to him out of the bush with a voice and said, Take off your shoes." And now we have a guy saying, take off your shoes. Same guy. One's a burning bush. It's God. We know it's God. You ask any Orthodox Jew, what was the voice from the burning bush? It was God. And that was the same voice that said, when Moses asked him, who should I say sent me? He said, I am, sent you. And then Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. And then they tried to stone him because he claimed to be God. Well, I think it's the same thing here. I think this is a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. And he shows up on the scene before the battle. And Joshua's, you know, trying to figure, do I have to fight this guy? Do I not have to fight this guy? Can I take him? Can I not take him? He's a guy, but he's armed, and so I better check. Is he on my side? Is he not? Who is he? And yet, he finds out who he's looking at is the Lord himself. And the question is not, is the Lord on your side? The question is, are you on God's side? I mean, that's really the question. You know, sometimes we get into a battle, and we get into this fight, and we're contending, especially, you know, when you want to contend for the faith and get out there and share your witness, and you know, it's like, God, are you with me? Are you with me? And you don't want to find out if God is with you. What you want to find out is, are you with God? Are you in a battle that he wants you to be in? Because really, the only ones you want to fight are the ones that he leads you into, and the only side you want to be on is his side. And if you find yourself in a position where you're in your battle and you're trying to talk God into being on your side, and whether it's a battle of what am I going to do for a job, or whether it's a battle for what am I going to find for a wife or a husband, or whether it's a battle of, you know, how am I going to witness to this person and drive them into the kingdom, whatever that case may be, the first thing you want to find out is, what's your side, Lord, so that I can be on your side? Because Joshua, and he is a guy who remembers that the battle is spiritual and it's not physical. And this guy shows up and says, I am captain of the host of the Lord. There's another army involved that's here. He only sees the leader. There's a whole other army. If you're familiar with the story of Elisha when he's in Dothan and the enemies surround him to take him because he's just telling the king everything that his enemies are going to do before it happens, he sends an army to get Elisha. And his servant freaks out, wakes up in the morning, looks out the window, and there's an army out there, and he just loses it, going, what are we going to do? And Elisha says, chill out, because there's more with us than there are with them. And then he prays that God would open his eyes, and all of a sudden, all around on the mountaintops, there's these chariots of fire, and his servant is allowed to see that there is another battle that he doesn't know about. There's another army that he's not aware of that's fighting on his behalf. And it's the same thing here. And Joshua realizes, there's another guy, and there's another army, and I want to be on that army side. And of course, he immediately drops to his face and he worships. It says, and Joshua did so. And, you know, as you go through Joshua's life, when you get to the end of it in Joshua chapter 24, it's going to tell us that he died servant of the Lord. Joshua, the servant of the Lord, died. I want that said of me. You know, I want to be, when I die, I have been the servant of the Lord all my life. That's really the only thing that is important, is that when I die, they don't say, there goes Steve, the servant of Steve, or, you know, there goes Steve, the servant of his employer, or the servant of his family, or whatever it is. I want it to say that I've been the servant of the Lord. And Joshua, time and time again, is obedient. And, you know, we've talked before about how this whole battle thing is an analogy not of going to heaven, but it's of going into the victorious Christian life. It's of living a life that is victorious. It's overcoming the problems of this life and living like a believer. And before that can even start, and they're going to start with the hardest thing. They're going to go to war against Jericho, and he's going to get the battle plan in the next chapter. And he says, okay, how are we going to take this city? And the Lord, this captain of the host, says, well, this is what you're going to do. You're going to go walk around it. And then you're going to come back and camp out again at the place where the stones are to remind yourself that I put you through the water. And then you're going to go walk around it again the next day. And oh, by the way, you're going to shut your mouth and you're not going to say anything. And then you're going to come back and you're going to see that. And you're going to do that for 6 days. You're going to walk around it once a day. They're going to start making fun of you probably day two, day three. I'm thinking they're really taunting them at this point. I'm not sure. But huge walls. And they're circling this place. And then they're going back and sitting there thinking, they weren't any shorter today than yesterday. I'm pretty sure. Been around that wall 6 times now. No shorter. No closer to getting through. And then on the 7th day, you're going to walk around it 7 times. Now, why would he even bother to do that? Why have them walk around it 6 times? Because he wants them to see their problem from every possible side and come to the conclusion that there is no way that they have a shot at taking that city. It's completely beyond your control. And I'll march you there every single day and then take you back to the place where there's a memorial that reminded you that you could have crossed that river where there was no possible way for you to do it. Better go look at those walls again. And then they go back around. And sometimes I feel like that's my life, you know. He shows me a situation, and I'm like, oh, I can't do anything with that. And then he trots me back to where there's a memorial to the last time he did something I couldn't figure out how to do. Oh, yeah, that's right. Now let's go look at it again. Oh, there's no way, God. What, did you see this? They're big. And there's even people making fun of me now, you know. No, I'll trot right on back. And they're going to do that 7 times. And then finally on the last time, he's going to say, now it's time for you to say something. Open your mouth. Everybody shouts, ah! They blow the horns, ah! The walls drop. And the whole thing goes down, and then they're just going to march inside. And it's to get them in a place where they realize it has nothing to do with them. But I find it interesting that before that can happen, they need to cut away the flesh. They need to remember that they've been bought and whose team they're on. And then they need to have a personal encounter with Christ. Living God. I mean, without a personal encounter with Christ, the rest of it's meaningless. Because you trot out there in your own flesh. And I did this. I remember I was in college, and I had grown up in a religious home. My parents were Christians. We had church in our house, and I was there, and I knew the Flannagraph stories, and I could, you know, sing Joshua and the Battle of Jericho, you know, and I knew all of that stuff, but I didn't know anything, and I didn't know the Lord. And then I went to school, and I got away from mommy and daddy's control, and I turned into what was on the inside, came out, and I started doing what I wanted to do all along, but had repressed, and was not a good guy. And then I went away for summer, and I spent some time at my sister's church down in Philadelphia, and I ran into these people who were my age. And they were Christians. And yet they had something I didn't have. They had joy without chemical enhancement. They had willpower to do things that I didn't have the willpower not to do. They had a peace, and they had a relationship that I had never seen. And I thought, wow, that's what I need. I need to be like them, and then I'll have that peace. That's what it is. I need to be like them. So I went back after that summer to college saying, I'm going to be like them. I'm going to do this thing. And yet, what I didn't have was a personal encounter with Jesus Christ. And that be like them lasted for all about a day and a half, you know. And the next thing you know, I was miserable again. And I was worse than I was before because I came to the place where I realized I couldn't be like that. And that's what we all need to get to, is a place where we realize you can't be like that. You can't do that. You can try. You might be able to fake it for a while. I had a lot of people fooled. But you can't be that without a personal encounter with Jesus Christ, without being on his side, fighting his battle under the power of his army. When that happens, you just walk up to it and you say, wow, you're right. There's no way I can do that one. And I think it's mercy, personally. I think it was the Lord's provision that they hit Jericho first, because Jericho was one of the biggest cities, and it was the most fortified, you know, 20-foot thick walls out front and thinner ones in the back, and at 30, 40 feet high, and double-walled city and all that. I think God was gracious in bringing them to one at the beginning that there was no way they could possibly. Because if it was a little one with, like, maybe just snow fences around the outside, or, you know, it's got a picket fence wall, I think we can do this. I think we can take them. And they'd be tempted to try that. But when they go to this one, there's no way. And God's going to fight for them. And so, you know, I look at that and I realize I need to have another personal encounter with the living God. I need to have one every single morning. And without that, we lose, you know. And I don't know what you're going through. I don't know where you are in your life. I don't know what struggles you're facing. But this life is a series of big walled cities that we don't seem to be able to get into in our own strength. And you can try. It's really frustrating because you lose, and I hate to lose. And, you know, and then he trots you back to the place and says, remember when I fought for you? We went through that river. You remember that? Oh, yeah, that's right. So, you know, if you are in that place where you've been trying to do it on your own without a personal encounter with the living God, let me encourage you, seek him. He is waiting. And then ask him, am I on your side? Would you fight for me? Well, tell me how we're going to do this thing. I want to fight according to your plan. certainly if you don't know the living God, if you've never had that personal encounter, if you've been the guy doing it or trying to do it, faking everybody into thinking that you've been doing it, but you've never really had it, you're going to fail. You need to meet him. And if you'd like to, see me afterwards and we can pray. So let me close in prayer. Bob, you want to do a song? Lord, please work in our lives. Give us the faith and the strength to trust you. Give us the power of your Spirit, Lord, and help us, Lord, to trust you. We pray, Lord, that we would not charge ahead in our own strength, Lord, but that you would fight, that you would go before us, and you'd win the battles. Lord, just help us to follow you. That's our desire. Lord, we want to see you. Please speak to us, we ask in Jesus' name.
Steve's guitar.
Still, Lord,